Hi, and welcome back to another edition of Occupy Interview with the OASN Radio. This episode is number... I've forgotten what number we're on. Our guest is Dr. Walter Block, and this is Occupy Growth. Dr. Block, it is an honor to get to talk to you.
It's a pleasure to be on your show. Thanks for having me.
We want to get started. Hopefully, my co-host, Melinda, will chime in here before too much longer. But just in case, we'll go ahead and kick the show off and get right started. There was a New York Times smear piece which portrayed you as some kind of a racist. Now, while I agree that they have the right to say what they want to say, that's freedom of speech, I have the right to be offended by being lied to and a mischaracterization of this. I'm familiar with your work. I wish Melinda was here. She's known you for years, and she'd be the first to say you are no racist. Please help us in the liberty movement. There's a problem with trying to balance freedom and freedom of speech. Do you have any thoughts on that, Dr. Block?
Oh, yes. I got lots of thoughts about that.
I suspected you might.
Yes. What happened is this guy from the New York Times called me and said he's doing a piece on libertarianism and he wants to understand what is libertarianism. So I must have spent 2 or 3 hours with him trying to teach him what libertarianism is. And as per usual, as a Rothbardian, the way I see libertarianism, it's predicated on the non-aggression principle. The non-aggression principle says you can do anything you want except keep your mitts off of other people and their property. That the only legitimate law is one that upholds the non-aggression principle by outlawing things like murder, rape, theft, slavery, arson, kidnapping, fraud, whatever, any way of interfering with other people and their property. And that's pretty much the essence of libertarianism. The rest of it is just the implications. Well, you know, what's our view on, I don't know, legalizing drugs or prostitution or whatever. And it was sort of a hard sell because the New York Times people are not really into libertarianism. It's sort of a vague kind of a thing. So I spent a lot of time trying to explain to him what it is. And I gave him dozens of different examples. And one of them is I went so far as to say that slavery, the big problem with slavery is that it violated the non-aggression principle or it violated free association, which is a parallel part of the non-aggression principle, namely you should not be forced to associate in any way with anyone that you don't want to associate with. For example, the problem with rape is that the victim has to associate with the rapist, and she doesn't want to associate with him. The problem with slavery is that the slave has to associate with the master or the overseer, and that's the last thing the slave wants to do. The slave wants to be free and, you know, not associate with these people who are whipping him. And so I said that the only problem with slavery was not the cotton picking or the gruel or the fact that he lived in a little house or any of that. The only problem was that it was compulsory. If, hypothetically, it was voluntary, weird case, then the whole venom would go out of slavery. Slavery would be unobjectionable. No libertarian would object to voluntary slavery. I mean, if the people wanted to be slaves, well, then fine. But in actual point of fact, you know, none of them wanted to be slaves. The whole idea is grotesque. The only reason I mention it is to emphasize the importance of voluntarism, of free association, of non-aggression. So out of this, the New York Times concocts the view that I say slavery isn't so bad. What he means by that is actual slavery. Well, actual slavery was horrible. It was despicable. It was horrendous. It was barbaric. It was monstrous. So he totally took what I said out of context and made me into some sort of pro-slavery racist type of person, which is, you know, as a libertarian, I mean, come on, give me a break. That's just silly. So then what happened is that the president of my university, without asking me about this, and about 18 members of my faculty, none, however, from the economics department, thankfully, wrote a letter saying, oh, Block is a disgrace to Loyola University because he accommodates slavery, and, you know, he thinks slavery isn't so bad. And, you know, these people just got it from the New York Times and didn't even have the courtesy to ask me about my views on this and was I quoted correctly. So that's sort of what's happening in my little neck of the woods.
I find it shocking that a university, I guess I shouldn't be shocked, but I do find it shocking that a university, and the root word there was universe, that you were supposed to be exposed to the universe of knowledge, the pursuit of truth. The youth are being misserved when they are only getting one view or one shade of a view. And particularly one of the best professors that I had when I was in college had been trained by the Jesuits. He was superb. They have a superb education system. I'm really hoping that Loyola reconsiders. It would be a shame to have your voice lost. And we definitely need you teaching the next generation of economics people. The Liberty Movement, I sent you a set of links. Hopefully you had enough time to take a look at it. But the Liberty Movement in general is being divided, divide and conquer, divide and rule. You're really pretty fair historian on top of being a critic. I'm sure you know how that's been used for centuries. Divide and conquer is also messing up the Liberty Movement. Again, there'll be some links up. But did you have any thoughts on how do we balance out the freedom of speech that yes, people have the right to say whatever they want to say, but how do we balance that out against we have the right to be offended by what is being said, and it's driving people away from the Liberty Movement.
Yes. Well, if the general public thinks that libertarians favor slavery, we're not going to be doing too well. So that's certainly a problem. You know, libertarians, the way I understand it, are not absolutists on free speech. There are certain statements, namely threats, that would be illegitimate because the non-aggression principle goes against not only actual physical violence against people and their property, but even the threat. So if I were to say to you, hypothetically, give me your money or I'll shoot you, that is just a mere statement, but it's a threat, and therefore I have no right to say it. And if I was saying it seriously, which I'm not, and nowadays I have to clarify, I'm not saying that seriously. But if I were, then I would be a criminal, and I would be in violation of the libertarian law. So if I say it to you now in a philosophical discussion, or somebody says that in a movie or in a play, that's okay. But other than that, libertarians believe in free speech. In my book, Defending the Undefendable, I even came out with a chapter about yelling fire in a crowded theater. Namely, it was a sadomasochistic theater, and that was the way that the sadists and masochists did their thing, and it was clearly announced, well, then that would be okay. So we're pretty far out there in terms of free speech, but not all the way. We're not 100% absolutist. We believe that there are certain speech acts, namely threats, serious threats, that would be illegitimate. But how do you balance that? Well, I don't know. I think the New York Times has the right to say what they damn well please. They could say, I favor slavery, I favor kidnapping, I favor rape, I favor racism. They can say whatever they want. It's a free country. As long as they don't threaten me, and they haven't threatened me, they haven't done anything like that. So they have a right to speak or write, as in the case of a publication like that. I was at one time contemplating suing them for libel, which is sort of a paradox for libertarians because we don't believe in libel laws. I have another chapter in my book, Defending the Undefendable 1. I now have two Defending the Undefendables, so there's number 2 out as well. But in Defending the Undefendable 1, I have a thing about libel. And the idea here is that libel is not a crime in the libertarian law code because... If I libel you, suppose I now say, you take a bath with a rubber ducky, and everybody hates anyone who takes a bath with a rubber ducky.
I was really hoping you weren't going to expose my rubber duck, but but now that it's out there, go ahead.
Sorry, you fetishists, you have to come out of the closet. I have no mercy for you people who take baths with rubber duckies. And so, you know, nobody wants to play with you. Nobody wants to hire you. Terry Bain's name is mud. And you'd think that I've stolen something from you, namely your reputation. And libertarians are against stealing your shoes or your TV or your car, and what about your reputation? But the paradox here is that your reputation does not consist of your thoughts about you. Rather, your reputation consists of the thoughts of everybody else about you. And since you can't own our thoughts, paradoxically, you can't own your reputation, because your reputation consists only of our thoughts, and you don't own them, so you don't own your reputation. So therefore, there would be no libel law in the free society. Then how do I even contemplate possibly suing the New York Times when I think that libel, they have a right to engage in libel? And my analysis here is, well, they're a member of the ruling class. And the libertarian non-aggression principle only applies to innocent people. It doesn't apply to ruling class members, people who are mouthpieces for statism, people who contribute to statism, people who work with the CIA, people like that. So I think that there's nothing I would not be incompatible with libertarianism were I to sue them, but I'm really not contemplating seriously doing it, because my understanding is it costs like $30,000 to $50,000 just in fees, apart from lawyer fees. And it would take a lot of time to do it, and during the time I could be doing that, I could be writing a book or a dozen articles, and I think I'd rather do that. So I'm taking the view that I have a right to sue them because they're a member of the ruling class, but I think that I'm not going to. But that doesn't stop me from talking about how unfair they've been and misquoting me and quoting me out of context.
And having the right to take offense. We've only got about 8 minutes left in this segment. I looked up the derivation of the word defense because I'm just weird and kind of a history guy, and it, like a lot of English words, it kind of has two connotations, and strangely enough, they kind of come down to your name and my name. The more primitive version might be the Anglo-Saxon root to it, which was kill, bane, like wolf bane. A more civilized view would be almost a forerunner of the non-aggression principle, to block, to defend, to not be violent, but to be self-defense.
You linguists are amazing.
It's a clear sign I have too much time on my hands. But the point being, I guess what I'm trying to get back to is, it's intent. That's kind of what is perhaps that the balance here, that perhaps people need to kind of look for the balance as, is there intent to harm? Thinking out loud.
Well, you know, when the New York Times so egregiously quoted me out of context, I was contemplating, well, why did they do it? Was it stupidity or malevolence? And I sort of veered toward the latter. I think it was just nastiness on the part of the New York Times. Because the interviewer, Sam Townhouse, didn't seem really stupid to me. He didn't seem stupid to me at all. He seemed like a bright guy. But by the way, the New York Times thing was not really a hit piece on me. It was a hit piece on Rand Paul. And what it did is it quoted, five or eight or ten libertarians, including me, all of whom had said something bad, like in my case that slavery was okay. Ha, ha, ha. What it implied was, well, since Rand is a libertarian and I'm a libertarian and these other guys are libertarians, then Rand is responsible for everything that any of us said, which is, slightly problematic as well. So
I'll have links up to that discussion, and I came into this. We tried to talk to you last year and had problems with recording, and we tried to accelerate getting a chance to talk to you this way. I got when I saw that this was going on, it was a perfect lead-in to the liberty movement being divided, divide and conquer, divide and rule. So that was really it's kind of off the subject because really we really need to spend the time on economics rather than the New York Times, which the latest figures are showing about 40% of people paying attention to what's laughingly called the mainstream media. They don't tell the truth. It's hard to be a newspaper if you're not telling the news.
This is the newspaper of Walter Duranty, who in the 30s went over to the Soviet Union when they were having that mass starvation and said that everything is fine with communism over there. So Tannehouse is following the footsteps of Walter Duranty. But I think you're right. We probably shouldn't spend too much time on socialist rags like the New York Times.
There was one question I had, and it came in from a guest, and that's why I sent the link. Antonio Bueller is another vital part, one of the younger people in the Liberty Movement, and I'll have links up to showing just how divisive the racism is, sexism is, all of the isms that can be thrown in here to try to keep us from looking at who really is the problem here. But he asked me to ask you, do you see any way that somewhere in the future these things will be settled out? Is there going to be a freedom movement somewhere in the future that can have a balance to this? And we've only got about 5 minutes in this segment, but he was curious what your thoughts would be. What do you see in the future for liberty?
Well, I'm not one of the optimists. I'm sort of more of a pessimist. But I don't really like to get into optimism and pessimism because if there's a case for optimism, then people will sit back and relax and let liberty flow over them. And if there's a case for pessimism, then people will say, oh, well, it'll never come, so I shouldn't act. In my case, I don't really care whether we're going to win or not, although obviously I favor us winning. But I'm going to do the same thing, exact same thing, whether we're on the ascendancy or the descendancy. Namely, I'm going to promote liberty to the best of my ability, and if we're winning, great, and if we're losing, I'm still going to do my best to promote liberty. So it really doesn't matter. However, to answer the question, I mean, I'm a professor. I'm never supposed to answer questions directly, so I'm now going around it, and now let me answer it. I'm a pessimist. I think that sociobiology indicates that we are hardwired with a predilection towards statism. We have this thing, the chief of the tribe or whatever, we've got to listen to the chief of the tribe, and we have to listen to majority rule, and a majority rule is all too often in favor of statism. So I don't see us winning, although I tell you, when I got into the Liberty Movement in around 1962, I first met Murray Rothbard in around 1965, and I asked him, well, how many libertarians are there in the whole world? And he said, oh, maybe 25 or something like that. Now there are probably, I don't know, 25 million around the whole world that are libertarians. The Ron Paul phenomenon is just phenomenal. The Ayn Rand phenomenon, where she attracted many people to the Liberty Movement. We're doing way, way, way better than when I started, and if we extrapolate and continue this way, I mean, we're going to be doing pretty well, but I still think it's sort of like the rock of Sisyphus. You know, you push it up the mountain and then it starts rolling down. Every freshman class I get, you know, is filled with the milk of human kindness and are economically illiterate, and they say, well, we got to have welfare, and we got to have a minimum wage, and we got to have taxes, and we got to have government. And it's a hard slog to argue them out of. And I asked, well, why is it that they come to me as freshmen like that? And the easy answer is, well, they got it from high school or from middle school or from TV or something. But then the harder question is, well, why is high school teachers and elementary school teachers and radio and TV and newspapers, why are they all like that? And I go back to biology, hardwiring. There's something about the human race, and there are mutants. Libertarians are mutants, so we're out of step with everyone else. But the vast majority of people, I mean, you know, look at what's going on in India where they're raping people, and in other countries in Africa and Asia where it's even worse than the United States, God forbid. So I think that maybe in 100,000 years we'll win, but it doesn't matter because biology takes a while. But, you know, right
I'm crying right now, doctor.
But I think it's the duty of every libertarian to do his best to promote liberty. And as I say, if there's the case for optimism and we're winning, great, pile it on, let's get there quicker. And if we're losing, well, then let's be the remnant. Let's keep the precious flame of liberty alive. And the only way we can do it is by everybody pushing their shoulders to the wheel and promoting liberty.
Well, I'm not really a libertarian. I'm a classical liberal. So perhaps just the concept that a classical liberal and a libertarian are sitting down from what should be two opposite sides of the aisle. Perhaps there's hope. I hope there's hope, because I've got a terrible feeling I'm going to end up in Guantanamo Bay if we don't win this. And I don't want to go there.
I see classical liberals as part of the broad libertarian movement. The way I see the libertarian movement, maybe 1-2% of it are anarcho-capitalists or anarchists. And maybe another 30-40% are minarchists, minimal governmentists, namely government should have only one role, namely to protect persons and property. And for that, you need only three institutions: armies to keep foreign guys off of us, police to keep local bad guys off of us, and courts to tell who the good guys and the bad guys are. And then liberals, like classical liberals like Milton Friedman or Friedrich Hayek, who are, would add a few more functions of government. And I see all of it as libertarian, so I use the word libertarian to refer to all three. So I regard you as a fellow libertarian, but just of a different type.
I think that's a beautiful lead-in to where we really need to go here, or at least my perception of where we really need to go here. We've been trying to get an economist to speak to us. For the better part of 2 years, coming up on 3 years, and there's been a real scarcity of economics people with the courage to be able to address the concept of, look, we've got a problem here in economics. Basically, there's kind of two flavors going on right now. You've got Keynesians printing money, and that's a concept of growth, and I'm oversimplifying this, please forgive me. Or you've got austerity, cut the budget, whatever the cost of that may be. There used to be a third option. I come from the history camp more than the economics camp. Frederick Jackson, my dyslexia just kicked in, but frontierism is one of the schools of history. And basically, his position was that there was the reason the American economics and freedom evolved the way it did was because of the influence of an open frontier, of the ability to grow. If you didn't like it here, you pick up your feet, you vote with your feet, and you move to someplace and do what you want to do. Can you touch on that fairly quickly?
Well, yes. I think in economics, the two schools of thought are mainly the monetarists and the Keynesians. And the third group, of which I'm a member, is the Austrian school of economics, Mises and Hayek and Rothbard. With regard to the frontier thesis, I'm not a devotee of that. I don't think that the reason we were successful is because we had an open frontier in the earlier days, and I don't think the reason we're failing now is because the frontier is filled in. I think the reason we were successful in the earlier days is we had closer to laissez-faire capitalism, and the reason we're wallowing now is because we've moved away from laissez-faire capitalism to some sort of socialist, fascist kind of economic system.
I can see that from a historic point of view. And again, this is your area of expertise, so I see exactly where that's coming from, but back from the historic point of view, the laissez-faire capitalism from Adam Smith takes a wrong turn to somebody who's a frontierist, when it got to the first professional economist, Malthus. Do we have any alternatives? I mean, the pervasiveness of what Malthus has done, and again, there'll be links up. We did a whole show on this. The concept of controlled growth or no growth is a part of the paradigm that we've all had you were talking about why do the kids come in with some of the misperceptions they have. And basically it comes down to they don't even conceive that there's any other possibility other than Mr. Malthus's formula. Well, there's always more people and there's only one world, so you're constantly going to get a smaller and smaller per capita share of world. And that's wrong. Since 1969, the aerospace guys, European space industry, they basically consider Earth moon as a binary planet system. And it's kind of technical, but they're saying that moon is too big. We basically in 69, we increased the supply of known world, doubled the supply of known world. And since then we've discovered anywhere out through the solar system. The upshot of all of this is why do we not even consider growth as an option? Can you help me with this? I don't understand where this is coming from in economics.
Well, I'm not a big fan of Malthus. Malthus thought that we were doomed to a subsistence level of income. And when we had more money, or rather more wealth than mere subsistence, we would then increase the size of the population. And then the population would run again, you know, population increases geometrically 2, 4, 8, 16, whereas food only appreciates arithmetically 1, 2, 3, 4. And we would run out of food, and then we would either have a pestilence or disease or war or starvation or something, and then the population would go below the subsistence level, and then we would have enough, and then the population would increase up to the subsistence level, and then it would go past it, and then we would have the cycle of deaths due to war or disease or whatever. But I think that that's just wrong. I'm not a Malthusian. I don't think there's any limit to growth. I think the subsistence level is just so wrong-headed in so many ways. Now, you said that we have a segment is ending soon. Should we talk about this now, or should we postpone it for the next segment?
We've got the whole rest of the hour. Basically, we've got 34 minutes.
Okay.
And this is the most crucial point that I can see in economics at this point. That the Malthusians seem to have taken the field at this point.
Yes. Unfortunately,
how do we change that paradigm, Doctor?
Well, let me give you why I think subsistence is wrong. The Malthusian theory of subsistence level of population is wrong. And the reason it's wrong is slavery. I hate to get back to slavery, and I don't want anyone to interpret me as favoring slavery, but I'm now going to use slavery not as a moral thing, that slavery is good, as I've been accused of by the New York Times, but rather slavery is an analytic tool. I'm going to try to get into the economics of slavery as opposed to the ethics of slavery. So what's the economics of slavery? Why do we want to have a slave, or why would any slave master bid for a slave? Why would it pay any person to capture a slave and enslave a free person and make him a slave? And the reason is because you can get more out of him than it costs you to feed him. Give him shelter and give him enough food and shelter so that he can at least replace his numbers. The reason you want a slave, and the reason people were willing to pay a positive price for a slave is because slaves could produce more than mere subsistence level. Well, if slaves could produce more than mere subsistence level, then certainly free people could produce more than subsistence level. And yet we've always had slavery throughout all of history, and probably even before recorded history, there was slavery. There was slavery in biblical times, and probably 5, 10, 15,000 years ago, people were preying on each other and enslaving each other. It was all horrible, but the point is that slavery existed from time immemorial. And yet, if the subsistence level theory of Malthus is correct, slavery would be impossible, because who would pay a plug nickel for a slave if the slave couldn't produce more than was needed to keep him subsisting? In other words, suppose subsistence means $100 a year worth of food, and food and clothing and shelter. And all the slave could produce was $100 worth, and yet the slave needed $100 to stay alive. Namely, the slave couldn't get you anything over and above what you had to give him to keep him alive. Well, why would you want a slave like that? Why would you bid for a slave like that? Why would there be a positive price? During slavery before 1861, people were paying hundreds of dollars, and that's when a dollar meant something, hundreds of dollars for a slave, which indicates that they thought that the slave could produce more than was necessary to keep him subsisting, keep him alive. Well, that shows that even slaves weren't at the subsistence level. Well, if slaves weren't at the subsistence level, then certainly free men wouldn't be. Even if they had equal ability, you don't need overseers to watch free men. You needed overseers to watch slaves and keep them from escaping, and you'd have to deduct their costs from the cost of the productivity of the slave. So Malthusianism just doesn't make any sense. It's just silly. It's proven by the fact that slavery existed that we never could have been in this kind of subsistence level. Now, I mean in a general sense. Now, obviously, if there was a storm or if there was a typhoon or if there was a drought, then it's some area on the earth. At some times in the past, we might have been in subsistence, but the Malthusian view was that we were subsistence always throughout the whole world, which is just utter nonsense. And, you know, look at us now. I mean, we've got color TV and air conditioners and, you know, airplanes and all sorts of toys. We're nowhere near subsistence, and the population isn't growing that much. I think that this Earth, which now has, I think, 7 billion people on it, could probably have, I don't know, 100 billion people on it if we wanted to, if we had laissez-faire capitalism and we had enough productivity. Now, obviously, there's a certain point where there'd be too many people for the Earth, I suppose. You know, if we had a trillion people on the Earth, there'd be too many. But there'd be no standing room, although we could dig tunnels and build 150-story buildings so we could get a lot of people in them. But the point is that if and when we were moving toward a trillion people, and that's a long way from today, probably we'd be on the moon, we'd be on Mars, and maybe, I don't know, we could colonize one of the moons of Neptune or Saturn or one of those guys, I don't know. So I'm a long-term optimist for the human race about, you know, running out of resources. That's just silly. Who was it that said that the brain is the ultimate resource or man's intelligence? Julian Simon wrote a book, The Ultimate Resource, which he meant was man's brain. You know, we've got people like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates creating all sorts of wealth out of sand, pretty much.
Silicon dioxide, yes, sand.
Yeah, so I don't see any problem, and I think Malthusianism is just a wrong-headed economic theory.
Okay, so we've got the basics here, and again, when Malthus did his thing, he tried to prop this busted play up with four different editions in his own lifetime, and it was proven wrong in all four different editions, but still, the idea prevailed. We did a show called Occupy Malthus, and that was Melinda Pillsbury Foster helped me find the answer that I'd been looking for about 30 years as to why does this obviously flawed idea continue to keep rearing its ugly head and holding us back. And it comes down to ponerology. And I may have mispronounced
Say that word again.
I probably mispronounced it. Ponerology, the study of the science of evil.
Oh, I never heard that word. Okay, live and learn.
I was taught it by two. I'm never the smartest guy in the room. And I've had, that's been the great part of doing this show is I've got to talk to some of the brightest men, not in the room, but on the entire planet. Dr. Edwin Vieira. Was the one who suggested I read the book. And again, there'll be a link at with this page that talks about ponerology, that there is a science of evil, that the actual book is written by a guy who got to see it up close and personal. He lived in Poland during the occupation of Poland by the Nazis. He got a he was part of a research group that was looking into it from the psychological and the psychosociobiological aspects of just how do you get this type of a system that grows and spawns. It's almost like it's a living entity, like cancer. And then after the Nazi regime left Poland, he said their research group barely survived the Nazis. And when the communist regime came in and took over, which theoretically is two completely polar opposites, left wing, right wing, he said that was the real problem, and they wiped out everyone in the research team. And I'll just put a link up, and people can make their own decisions. But part of the science of the study of evil is that a psychopath is only about 4% of the population. A psychopath being defined as somebody who just does not care about the concept of what he does to another individual, part of your non-aggression principle. And basically it's brain damage that you can show on a CAT scan, on tomography, that there is brain damage, actual demonstrable damage to a person's brain. Again, I don't really want to get too far off in this, other than, okay, 4% of the population, and his study is how that 4% also influences about 16% who has been damaged by being brought up by people who were psychopaths. So about less than 20% of the population is holding down 80% of the population throughout all of history. And again, us weird history people are always looking for universal history. And this was a pretty good answer. I'm sure that's triggered off some thoughts. What are you? I guess this is new to you.
No, I've heard the 80%, 20%. I think that's pretty accurate. You know, everybody now is against the 1% because they're greedy or something. But you know, the 1% top income earners are all that's standing between us and barbarism. I mean, and starvation. Well, maybe not just 1%, but maybe the top 20%, top 30%. These are the people that work hard, that work smart, that work all day, that take few vacations, that save a lot of money. These are the backbone of the economy. So I'm a big fan of people who are in the top quintile, top 20%. These are the people who pay most of the taxes. These are the people who are the employers. These are the people who create jobs. These are the people who create new products, air conditioning, new ways of selling like McDonald's or Walmart. These are the people who are the heroes. Ayn Rand called, businessmen the most persecuted minority? Well, honest businessmen are. Of course, there are crooked businessmen who are in the crony capitalist area, which is a very different kind of a thing. But I would agree that these are the captains of industry are the people we ought to be having ticker tape parades for. We ought to be carrying around them on our shoulders like we carry around football players who win or basketball players or whatever or sports stars or movie stars. These are the unsung heroes. This is the reason that when you open your refrigerator in the morning, you got some orange juice, you got some eggs, you got some Coca-Cola or whatever, and when it's cold, you got heat, and when it's hot, you've got some air conditioning. Without these people, our society would more resemble some of the societies in Africa or Asia or South America where they're in very, very poor shape.
That was basically the principle of the book of Phonerology. He doesn't take it to the history. He's coming from the psychology point of view. But for the history people, it ties in with, again, this is the Occupy America social network. The 99% is actually probably the 99.9%, and there are mathematics studies that show the control influences, and then probably you can take it down to the 99.9 and a couple more decimal points. And basically that's what this show is so crucial. We've got about 22 minutes left in the hour, and how do we engineer growth? How do we have this breakout. If our two choices here is to grow or to continue doing what we're doing, which is not looking real good, as an economist, how do we create growth?
Well, the way we create growth, the way we create wealth, I think, is laissez-faire capitalism. That government is best which governs least. If we have to have a government, and the anarcho-libertarians would say we don't, that private enterprise can do it all, that government should do very little. It should just have armies, as I said, to protect us against foreign bad guys, not to go all around the world with, 1,000 military bases in about 160 different countries, and every time two tribes are at each other's throats, the U.S. is involved. And I mean, we're involved everywhere. Syria, Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, everywhere. Germany, we got troops in Japan. So Ron Paul, who is one of my heroes, if he would have become president, he would have said, you know, bring all the troops home. The second strand of this minarchist or minimal government view is local police, to keep local bad guys off of us. But what are the police doing? Yes, okay, sometimes they do stop rapists and murderers, and that's all to the good. But all too often what they're doing is pursuing victimless criminals like drugs and prostitution and gambling and pornography and things like that. Anything between consenting adults, or as Robert Nozick said, any capitalist act between consenting adults ought to be legal. So those cops ought not to be spending time putting people in jail. I mean, the U.S. is the jail capital of the world. We've, on a per capita basis, we've got more people in jail for victimless crimes than any other country in the world. So one way to have more growth is to bring all the troops home and put them to work. Another is to get the cops to stop putting innocent people in jail. A third one is the courts. The courts should not force, I don't know, what was it, a Christian baker to make cakes for a lesbian couple for their wedding. The court should not be grabbing people's property and using eminent domain on it. Another problem is the Fed. Federal Reserve System is just screwing around with our money supply. If you look at the 100 years before and after 1913, when the Fed started, before, we didn't have much of a business cycle. Oh, a little bit in 1819, 1807, I think 1873, but that was due to the central bank, and we didn't really have laissez-faire gold standard. But after 1913, we've been reaping the whirlwind. We've been having a business cycle up and down, and unemployment, vast unemployment, inflation. So if you ask, what's the way to have growth, what's the way to have prosperity, the answer is laissez-faire capitalism, free markets, free enterprise. Get the government out of it. Get the government to stop with the stupid regulations. There are these black girls that braid hair, mainly hair of other black people. And in order to do it legally, they have to take 60,000 hours worth of, hair theory or something in some college, whereas they can do hair braiding perfectly well just as is. And the government regulates them. There was this case I just read about in the papers today where they're having some trouble in New Jersey because they don't have enough salt. And they've got tons of salt in Maine. But and there's a ship in Maine that could bring the salt from Maine to New Jersey where they need it for the ice and snow. But there's a Jones Act of 1920, I think it is, that forbids any transport of U.S. goods between U.S. ports unless it's a U.S. ship. And this ship that's in Maine now is a foreign ship, so it is precluded by law from carrying salt from one U.S. city to another U.S. city. I mean, do we have to shoot ourselves in the foot all the time? And sometimes we're shooting ourselves a little higher up than the foot. So, you know, government is just, with its minimum wages and its welfare system that breaks up the black family and creates welfare dependency, the list goes on and on. I mean, what is it? There are like 10,000 pages of new regulations coming out every day from our friends in Washington, D.C. I think, 8 out of the richest counties in the U.S. are all clustered around Washington, D.C., because that's where the money goes, and they skim quite a bit of it off. So the question is, how can we have economic growth? How can we have wealth? How can we have prosperity? Get the government to stop the market from creating these things, because the market is the most magnificent engine for creating wealth and prosperity, and the government is just stopping it here, there, and everywhere.
At this point, if I was regular Occupy movement, if there was a monolithic Occupy movement, which is absolutely impossible when you're talking about 99% of the population, basically there's a very, in the Occupy movement, there's a big distrust of capitalism in general.
Oh, yeah.
Can you address what our listeners are familiar, they have been exposed to the ideas of a historian named Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, that's talking about this is not capitalism that we're living in right now. This is monopoly capitalism that we're living in right now.
Very good point.
And then you have another superb historian named Anthony Sutton that our listeners have been exposed to his ideas. And he not only takes the concepts, but he footnotes it down to the limit, which is what a historian is supposed to do.
I think you're making a very good point. You're putting your thumb right on the issue. Take the Pope, the recent Pope Francis, who said capitalism is evil. What he doesn't distinguish between is laissez-faire capitalism and crony capitalism. What we now have is, as you called it, monopoly capitalism or monopoly state corporate capitalism or crony capitalism, where you have bailouts for Wall Street and you have bailouts for the big banks and bailouts for the big unions in Detroit. Look at what they've done. Look at what government has done to Detroit. It's just horrible. So you have to distinguish between laissez-faire capitalism, where the only way to make money is by producing something that consumers want, on the one hand, and on the other hand, crony corporate monopoly state capitalism, which is really economic fascism, where you can make money not by producing goods and services for people, but by getting regulations passed that hamstring your competitors, by getting subsidies, by getting sort of all sorts of benefits from government. And that's what people think of as capitalism. That's what the Occupy movement thinks of as capitalism. That's what the Pope thinks of as capitalism. He's from Argentina. He thinks that what they've got in Argentina is capitalism, and he's against it. Well, I'm against it, too. If that was what capitalism was, I'd be against capitalism, too. And since they're against capitalism, they start embracing socialism. But socialism is no good either. So what we've got to do is get rid of both corporate state monopoly capitalism or fascism and socialism. You see, a lot of people make the mistake. They think that fascism, you have to have a little mustache and you have to have a swastika and you have to have boots and you have to have a goose step and you have to have concentration camps. Well, that's political fascism, but economic fascism is heavy government regulation. Obama is not a socialist. Obama is more of a fascist. The only socialism he's got is where he took a little bit of government ownership of, what was it, not Ford, but GM and Chrysler. Very, very slight socialism. The health care is not really socialism, more fascism, more government regulation. So what we've got to do is fight both, and we can't say, well, because we're against socialism, we want to embrace fascism, nor can we say because we're against fascism, we want to embrace socialism. A pox on both their houses. We've got to embrace free market capitalism, free enterprise, laissez-faire capitalism.
We've got about 12 minutes left. The second historian I mentioned, Dr. Anthony Sutton, his life's work, he started out with the Hoover Institute, and he was documenting that Wall Street backed the communists, the rise of communism. He then did the next step in there. He also documented that Wall Street was backing the rise of Hitler, fascism, and he also documented that Wall Street backed the rise of FDR, the American version, the end of liberal. Basically, where I have to keep defending myself as a liberal, which I resent and I find offensive because the word means worthy of free men. How do we possibly consider the word liberal as an insult?
Our friends on the left stole that word from us. It used to be classical liberal, and we were all classical liberals, and they stole the word from us, and they're trying to steal the word libertarian from us as well. Look, my analysis of Wall Street and Hitler is a little bit different, but similar to what you mentioned. My analysis starts not with World War II, but with World War I. It's not really original with me, but I'm talking about libertarian historians like Ralph Franco and Murray Rothbard. And the idea here, and I'm not sure I've got it exactly right, I'm no historian, but here is my limited understanding of what happened. What happened was World War I was evenly matched. The Axis and the Allied powers were fighting over 3 inches of turf. And they were killing tens of thousands of people. And if the war just lasted a little bit longer without the U.S. Mixing its big fat nose into it, probably they would have run out of soldiers and the war would have had to stop because it was just pitiful and brutal. It started in 14, and in 17 the U.S. got in there. Why did the U.S. get in there? Because Wall Street had more bonds with England than with Germany. So it was a purely corporate capitalist kind of a thing. I mean, there was no Hitler in World War One. There was no real difference between the two sides. It wasn't, you know, you had Hitler versus the good guys as in World War Two, although Hitler versus Stalin, I'm not sure who the good guy and the bad guy is there. But the point is that the U.S. Put its big fat thumb on the balance wheel and allowed the Allied powers to beat the Axis powers. Then you had the Treaty of Versailles. And the Treaty of Versailles was very, very punitive to Germany. It was saying that the whole war was Germany's fault and Germany owed reparations and we're going to take all the wealth out of Germany. And the people in Germany were practically starving. And then what you had was the hyperinflation of 1923, where the Central Bank of Germany did what all central banks do, is create money hand over fist. And you had not only the devastation of the Treaty of Versailles, not only the devastation of the World War One, but also the hyperinflation of 1923. And when you have a devastation like that, demagogues can get in. And Hitler got in. The Nazis started rising in the late 20s and early 30s. And that's why you had Hitler. That's why you had World War II, because, I mean, Hitler was a maniac. And not that Stalin was any better. If you look at how many people they killed, I think Stalin killed more people than Hitler.
Oh, yeah, he was a great Malthusian.
Oh, right, yes, that's right. Very, very good point. So the way I see it, it's U.S. imperialism. And that makes me sound sort of like a leftist, but I don't care. The left is against Republican wars. They're just not against Democratic wars. Where is the anti-war left now that Obama's in power? Why isn't the anti-war left? I mean, if Romney had come in or if McCain had come in and done exactly what the Nobel Peace Prize winner Obama had done in not getting out of Iraq, not getting out of Guantanamo, not getting out of Afghanistan, mixing in, well, he didn't mix in Syria, although the rabid Republicans wanted him to. The anti-war left would have been outraged. They would have been up in arms. But, you know, they're nowhere there. Well, at least they're against Republican wars, whereas the Republicans favor every war. So, you know, I favored Obama over McCain and Obama over Romney in 08 and 12 elections, mainly because of the foreign policy. Of course, if Ron Paul were in there, I wrote a book on Ron Paul, and I'm a big, big, big fan of Ron Paul. Ron Paul would have pulled all the troops back, and we would have been more moral, ethical, and more prosperous as well.
We've got about 8 minutes left to fix all of economics. I'm hoping to get Dr. Paul on the show. I've been in touch with his people, and so far we haven't been able to get our schedules synced up. But hopefully we get him on the show. And hopefully we also, again, our listeners are familiar with the historians that back up what you were just saying, that basically this is not an accident. There are people who've made a great deal of money out of being Malthusians. If we had the other option, let's make the bold assumption that the capitalism itself, that laissez-faire capitalism, isn't flawed, that it's the misapplication of monopoly capitalism. If we had one of the Rothschild family on the show, which we're trying to get, what we're looking for is just a policy change. If Malthus is the cause of the problem here, if stopping growth is the cause of the problem here, then Rothschild's fortune, the House of Rothschild makes their money whether it's wide open growth like the American frontier period that we both just talked about, you from the economic side, me from the history side. They made money with growth. They're making money off of controlled growth or no growth. If we had a Rothschild here, how would I make the case to him that growth is a viable option, that freedom still works? We've only got 6 whole minutes left. Please make the case for freedom.
Well,
doctor.
I think we've been doing that the whole hour. We can do 6 minutes more a bit. I mean, Charles Koch and David Koch are very, very wealthy zillionaire philanthropists that are promoting free enterprise. Bill Gates is sort of a lefty guy who's not really promoting economic freedom, but he is doing some good things, trying to cure disease in Africa and stuff like that. It's hard to make the case for the Rothschilds to the extent that they're in the ruling class, to the extent that they're corporate capitalists. They just want money, 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 and they don't care whether the money comes from government, as in corporate monopoly capitalism, crony capitalism, or whether it comes from the market.
I don't have a problem with the House of Rothschild making money. I have a problem with the policy of Malthusianism causing making money to be necessary to have bloodshed over it.
Yes.
If we had them on the show, what is our alternative? How do we do capitalism making money without having to kill people to do it?
Well, capitalism doesn't have to kill people. It's rather crony capitalism that has to kill people. It doesn't have to. There are other ways that they can make money besides killing people by just getting government subsidies or bailouts or whatever. I think we have to oppose unions. Look at what the unions did to Detroit. You know, there was a union move in, I think it was Alabama, for Volkswagen, where Volkswagen stupidly was sort of inviting the union to come in, and thank goodness that the workers in this plant rejected the union. Unions are like a tapeworm. They just sort of suck up all the activity, and then they leave a husk in Detroit. And before Detroit, it was the Rust Belt, pretty much all of the Northeast with the high minimum wages and high union rates. And what happened is these companies just went south, where there's more right-to-work law and more less receptivity to unions. I used to teach at the Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts. And in Worcester, Massachusetts, it wasn't a heavy steel place like Pennsylvania, but they made ball peen hammers and other metal things like rakes or screwdrivers, things like that. And they had, maybe 15 or 20 factories, each factory maybe 5 stories high and a quarter of a mile by a quarter of a mile. I calculated by driving past one. And these are just gigantic, gigantic places, all Detroitized, if I can use that word. They were all empty. And why? Because the unions demanded more and more money, and the employers went broke, or they moved down south, and that's why they want to have a high minimum wage so that the companies can't run down to get cheap labor. So I think unions are another institution that is bollocksing up the works, that's keeping us from prosperity and growth. And if you want to put it in your terminology, they're Malthusians. The way you're using Malthusianism is sort of for killers, but I don't know if I go along with that entirely or if I understood it entirely. But unions are certainly another institution that is holding us back, and the fewer of them we have, the more prosperous we'll be.
As a liberal, I am a supporter of the union movement, although I can see a difference between my, I know, perish the thought, but as a possibly there's a non-Malthusian unionism.
Well,
basically,
you know,
unionism
right.
is contract law, and that's a big part of non-aggression.
Well, you know, you're absolutely right. I stand corrected. Theoretically, unions are not per se a violation of libertarian non-aggression principle, because if what a union did was limit itself to one and only one activity, namely the threat or the actual mass walkout, then unions would be legitimate. But unions do more than just mass walkouts. What they do is they walk off the shop floor, and then they set up a picket line and try not to allow the owner of the factory to hire replacement workers, scabs. They try to beat up the scabs, so they get laws.
And that would be a clear violation of non-aggression.
Right.
Doctor,
right.
We are out of time. I really hope we can get you back on the show. We've got a lot of economics to rework here. I'm hoping that this show has given some of our listeners a little breath of hope that, hey, maybe freedom does still work. Maybe we need to reconsider the ideas that have been put into our heads by people who have made a lot of money out of putting these ideas into our heads. And maybe there's room for just a new view here, a new paradigm. We're out of time. Any last thought, Doctor?
Well, just thanks for having me. And despite my problems with Loyola, I want to put in a pitch for Loyola University. If you're a student or a high school student or thinking of transferring and you want to get some free market economics, come study with me and my four colleagues in the economics department, all of whom are very much in agreement with me in terms of free enterprise.
I will have a link to get people, because we badly need a new generation of economics people who are exposed to some of the ideas we've been talking about on this show. We've got to reconsider what is a correct premise and what isn't a correct premise. And we've just barely scratched the surface on that on this show. Again, hope to have you back. It's been great talking to you, Dr. Block. And
well, thanks again for having me on your show, and I look forward to a repeat performance.
Thanks for standing, Dr. Block. It's been an honor to talk to you here. And hopefully it won't be long before we get you back on.